food for the planets. The sun, which had disappeared beyond the horizon, took with it the last glimmers of its rays. The hot summer Monday promised a quiet night, and the cloudless sky finally revealed a few bright stars. Anna, stretching her arms to the sides, comfortably settled on the grass, gazed up dreamily and earnestly to the sky. Her gaze was unfocused and directed simultaneously at hundreds of bright points. It was unclear whether the stars were igniting anew every moment, or it was just an optical illusion, but the longer she stared at the heavenly canvas, the more flickering points she discovered. After a few minutes, the girl exclaimed with quiet excitement,
"Have you ever suspected that this was possible? Could you have imagined that everything could be so intricately and complexly arranged?"
Her words were addressed to Alexander, seated on the grass, poetically chewing on a soft blade. The man tilted his head upwards. His wide orange hood slid down his skull, revealing short, neatly trimmed fair hair.
"Of course I suspected. Just like you are now, looking up and suspecting,"
he said with a smile. Then, after a moment's pause, added,
"But, of course, when I met the master and learned how exactly it is arranged, all my suspicions turned out to be child's babble."
The girl closed her eyes, imagining the image of the keeper of knowledge. Immediately, a tender, gracious expression of pleasure and joy appeared on her face. The meeting with the master, who gradually revealed to her and other disciples new horizons of the great knowledge, turned her whole life upside down.
Today, when the master talked about the influence of the planets on us and about our interaction with cosmic bodies, I got goosebumps. I got answers to many questions that had been bothering me for a long time, but I would never have guessed to look for them myself in the interconnection with the cosmos myself.
Anna continued to share her impressions. Alexander silently listened. He had joined the school long before Anna became a disciple. The man blissfully smiled, remembering his own goosebumps, trembling each time he found himself near the keeper of knowledge in the powerful field of pure light energy. Meanwhile, the girl continued to ponder.
"I wonder, the dark entities, in their great variety, that attack humans, are they also the action of the planets? Or perhaps they are offsprings of the moon, which requires nourishment? Or maybe they are negative aspects of different planets? The master said that they can provoke negative emotions in humans to feed on them. But what do you think? Maybe the planets deliberately cultivate entire human civilizations only for nourishment?"
"A good question."
Alexander looked up again, then remarked ironically,
"Here we are, living on Earth, imagining ourselves as God knows who, but in fact, maybe we are just a sprouted seedling on someone else's large windowsill. You'll ask about it now."
The disciples heard a whistle, signaling the end of the break. Shaking off the grass, they hurried back to the cozy pavilion to continue the meeting with the Keeper of Knowledge and ask the pressing question. A few minutes later, Anna and Alexander, joining the group of other disciples, were already listening to the words of the Master, who with incomparable energy and artistry was unfolding and elucidating the truth before them.
"This is what happens,"
the sage explained with a soft, caring voice.
"Just as we breed livestock, such as sheep or cows, the planets breed us here on Earth and receive certain energies from humans."
At these words, Anna looked meaningfully at Alexander, pleased with her contemplation.
"The planets receive these energies,"
the Keeper of Knowledge continued.
"That's why they bred us here on Earth. However, unlike a cow, a human has intelligence and therefore the ability to choose. A smart person can think, why should I be led? I want to break out of this circle of influences and will not feed them with myself. That's it. I won't feed them. I will get out from under their influence. In such way, a smart person can think of and decide. But it's not so easy to do because negativity is inherent in us from the start. Negative emotions, various settings, and zombie programs have already been embedded in humans."
"So, to stop feeding the planets, we need to get rid of negativity?"
Perceptive disciple Milena clarified.
"Exactly,"
confirmed the great sage.
"We must rid ourselves of negative emotions, zombie programs, bad attitudes, and grievances. But it's difficult,
the sage repeated, making a pronounced pause.
People don't want to rid themselves of negative emotions. They cherish them, hold on to them, believe that without them, they cannot exist. That's why people continue to be food for the planets.
Having received the remarkable knowledge, Anna continued to develop her question.
Dear Master, but if there is no civilization on other planets, then where do they get the energy for existence? Or is it just our assumption that there isn't, while in reality there are many civilizations?
The sage warmed the inquisitive disciple with a tender glance and clarified.
There are inorganic beings. There are spirits. Scientists may claim that there is no biological life as such there. But other inorganic life, of course, exists there. There are various spirits, various beings. They are not like us, but they also emit some energy, which is also consumed by someone.
Such unusual information required time for comprehension. The disciples exchanged dismayed glances and generated new questions. A girl named Veronica cautiously raised her hand. It seemed that her thought had not yet fully formed, but she did not want to waste a second in gaining new knowledge.
Great one. When we experience elevated emotions, does that mean we stop feeding the planets?
Veronica spoke slowly, formulating the question on the go, and suddenly, a new idea was born from this.
So, does it mean that we start feeding something else? Someone must absorb this energy, right? So, are we feeding angels and higher powers?
The girl brightened.
After all, they help us, and we feed them with our energy for that, right?
Yes,
the master replied with pleasure to Veronica's enthusiastic look with an affirmative gesture.
If a person, for example, engages in creativity, it means that the sun has already started feeding with creative energy, with its creativity. And if elevated emotions arise, then the galactic center is already being nourished. It means that the person has become so enlightened at that moment that they have reached the galactic center. Therefore, we already come under higher influences that are closer to the absolute. And the closer the influence is to the absolute, the more benevolent it is for us, and the better it is for us. Therefore, we must strive to come under the highest influences and avoid lower negative influences.
With an affirmative gesture, the next question was asked by David. The tall, blue-eyed Georgian sat on the floor, crossing his legs, expressing complete tranquility. It seemed as if he was impersonating Buddha himself. The movements of the young man were smooth, and his voice was confident. When he spoke with a pronounced Caucasian accent, his speech was filled with deep respect and love for the keeper of knowledge.
Wisest Master, today we talk a lot about planets, but I have a question about stars. What is their purpose? How do stars influence us?
You asked an important question for everyone, David.
With this responsive phrase, the master attracted the attention of several disciples who were deeply immersed in their thoughts, and he was not mistaken. The disciples seemed to have caught the momentarily lost signal again. As if emerging from light forgetfulness, the disciples focused on the voice of the keeper of knowledge, looking straight into his eyes. Reading the signal reception from their faces, the master smiled kindly, and then answered David's question.
Stars also influence us, but since the planets are closer, their influence will be stronger. The nearest star to us is the sun. Its influence on a person largely depends on the level of development of their soul, on individual susceptibility. If, for example, the soul is at the lowest level of development, then the sun acts just like a planet. But if a person is at a higher level, then here
yes,
the sun already manifests as a star. So stars, of course, have an influence, but since they are farther away from us, their impact is weak, not so pronounced. To feel the influence of stars, you need to tune in specifically, desire it, be receptive, and ready to perceive this signal, like a solar battery. but it is also necessary to understand that their influence goes through the planets. If the position of a certain star coincides with the position of one of our planets in the horoscope, then already this star, through such a conducting planet, will influence us.
Can I ask about the moon? The moon also has a special influence on us, right, Master? I read in the Globe, the famous astrologist, about how depending on which lunar day and in which quarter of the moon a person is born, the age of the person's soul is determined. That is, the fuller the moon on that day, the wiser, older the soul is. Is that true? It was said there that at first, souls that have just been incarnated are born, and at the fourth stage, the wisest ones are born.
Yes, that's also true. One of the important factors is in which lunar quarter we are born. But not only the moon alone determines it for a person, so there are many other factors that can determine this.
David bowed to the sage, still maintaining his upright posture and unwavering calm. He had long been learning this from the Keeper of Knowledge and tried to practice the skill of high concentration daily. From the corner of the gazebo came the gentle voice of a young disciple. She was a slender girl with fair skin and beautiful curly hair. Her black, delicately arched eyebrows on her tender skin accentuated her green chrysolite eyes. All listeners involuntarily admired the charm of the sweet disciple. But soon, all attention turned to the essence of her question.
Dear Master, I've been thinking that according to the laws of nature, there should be some kind of energy consumption chain. Simply put, in nature, the strong always consumes the weak. If planets feed on the energy of humans or spirits, then who feeds on the energy of planets and stars? Is there someone higher in this hierarchy?
You've chosen the right train of thought, Diana.
The keeper spoke to the disciple affectionately, scanning the sensuality and ease of her energy field.
Yes, then, the stars are nourished by the planets, and in turn, the centers of the galaxy are nourished by the stars. Literally, this can even be seen. Imagine the standard image of a galaxy. In the center of each galaxy, there is always a huge black hole. Stars are concentrated around this hole. Like a large funnel, the black hole attracts them and consumes them. This is where the stars fly, thereby realizing their main purpose in the galaxy. So your example of the laws of nature in this case is quite fair.
The sage addressed the disciple's words, encouraging her with a touch of high regard.
Something greater, more massive, feeds on something less strong, less massive. Therefore, everyone devours each other in this universe, but we must know and regulate whom we feed. Angels or demons?
The Master's words once again set off a whole series of thought processes in the minds of those gathered. Some rubbed their temples thoughtfully. Some disciples took notes and now pensively lowered their eyes to their notebooks. At this moment, each one envisioned the image of a galactic food chain. One of the disciples associated the black hole with a huge blue whale, slowly traversing the vastness of the ocean depths, engulfing tiny plankton. The whale intermittently opened its wide mouth and sucked in small fish in one big gulp. The young man thought about these small fish. Are they scared when the watery vortex sucks them into the throat of the huge marine animal? Or perhaps the fish are more intelligent and calmly accept the inevitability of their fate. The disciple quickly drew a reverse analogy with cosmic bodies and raised his hand.
Tell me, Great One, can planets experience negative or positive emotions? Or maybe they just emit a certain specific energy background?
Yes, Kamal,
the Keeper of Knowledge responded.
Planets can also experience various emotions, but they manifest very differently. This is definite because if they feed on such weak vibrations, it means these vibrations exist within them as well.
In the disciple's imagination, the blue whale closed its mouth and emitted a deep but melodious vibrating sound as if confirming the master's words. Then it swam into the depths, carrying away the melancholic sounds of its whale song. Meanwhile, Maxim's thought about the emotions of planets continued to rapidly evolve and soon poured into the next reflective question.
Great one. But am I right in understanding that it's still impossible to change the emotional background of the entire planet? After all, planets feed on negative emotions, which is why such a long period of prosperity occurs. On Earth, only a small part of people is capable of experiencing elevated states and escaping from negativity, and fortunately, we are among them.
Here, the disciple looked at the audience with shining eyes, as if reminding the other disciples once again of the invaluable experience they gain by being close to the great sage and similarly enlightened people. Everyone caught this wave of unity, their chests filled with a sigh of sincere joy, and their gazes turned to the keeper of knowledge. The sage considered this strong, elevated emotion and sent a large stream of bright energy into the hall. Such a silent exchange of vibrations with the master gave much strength to continue the conversation. Kamal decided to continue.
As Gurdjieff and Uspensky wrote, there is not enough gold for everyone. Great esoteric knowledge is not accessible to all for understanding. Therefore, perhaps there is no need to try to make all people happy and enlightened, is there? Sometimes I have such elevated states when I really want everyone to understand this knowledge, and the whole planet becomes a flourishing paradise. But it's impossible, so we shouldn't strive for it. That's why we only choose the brightest souls from all. Am I reasoning correctly, Master?
Kamal's speech was very emotional, so the Keeper of Knowledge held a brief pause before speaking, giving the disciple a chance to exhale and tune in to accept the answer.
Yes, not everyone wants to understand the truth. Not everyone strives for it. A greater part of the planet is occupied by a senseless gray mass. This thought is very well traced in the songs of Yegor Letov from the Grazdanskaya Oborona group.
In the minds of some of the disciples, a line from a well-known song flashed instantly. The plastic world has triumphed. The mock-up turned out to be stronger. A light veil of sadness slightly covered their faces, but with the next words of the Keeper, the fog gradually dissipated.
That's why the gray mass occupies a huge place. These are the souls of people who have only recently reincarnated from bugs. Their souls are still underdeveloped, so they have no interest in any spiritual knowledge. And the gram of knowledge that falls to their share of understanding becomes unaccepted and rejected. I used to try to reach out to such people for a long time. For example, to my brother or to my unreasonable relatives. I tried to explain to them how to live righteously, but they wouldn't listen to me. They rejected the knowledge I gave them. But the truth is that smart people who want to develop, they take their share of knowledge that the bugs rejected. They take it for themselves because others reject it, don't want to listen or perceive anything. As a result, every intelligent person gets a lot of knowledge, and this energy is already enough for them to transform into an angel.
Lilia, a decisive and active girl, raised her hand sharply.
Master, can we clarify?
She asked with a ringing voice.
Can planets perish if all people strive for enlightenment and elevated emotions? After all, it seems that if there are no negative emotions on Earth, then the planets will have nothing to feed on, and they will start to decay?
The Keeper of Knowledge warmly looked at the disciple, and her fiery energy softened, coming into balance under the influence of the sage's calm and impartial gaze.
Yes, of course,
he replied.
Each planet has its own lifespan. Sooner or later, all planets perish. But let's think about it.
The master leaned closer to the disciples, as if shortening the distance for better understanding of his words.
If nobody experiences negative emotions, then the planets would start starving, which, of course, would lead to their destruction. But is that possible? It's not the case that everyone suddenly becomes wiser, so there is always food for the planets. The thing is, Earth is a place for lower souls. Higher souls have already reincarnated into angels and continue to live in the subtle level. But those who are at the beginning of their development, those whom we jokingly call bugs, they incarnate on Earth. These are lower souls, and they have not yet reached higher development, so they cannot cultivate anything other than negative emotions. Something bright certainly slips through, but predominantly negativity prevails around them. Therefore, there will always be food for the planets.
Lilia bowed to the Great Keeper, thanking him and simultaneously contemplating his words. Today's conversation topic was quite complex, and the disciples were particularly excited by the novelty of the knowledge they received. Their questions became deeper each time, and ideas and thoughts transformed into unusual forms, sometimes surprising the master. Yet there was no question to which the Keeper of Knowledge could not convey the words of truth. In this lay his undeniable genius, and in this was his power.
Great one. Can we translate this entire food chain into hydrogens?
Michael, a mature man of short stature with a distinct bald spot, rose from his seat. Michael had read all the books written by the Keeper of Knowledge, as well as about half of the literature recommended by the Master. Possessing an excellent memory, the disciple skillfully made connections between different spheres of knowledge. And the question he asked was also the result of integrating several already studied and assimilated topics.
Master, can we translate this entire food chain into hydrogens?
The man asked cautiously, as if trying a new and unusual approach to the subject of discussion.
We consume food, H768, but planets need a more subtle energy. What do they feed on if translated into hydrogens? Our biofield, H96? Or perhaps emotions, meaning H24? Am I reasoning correctly that planets, being more subtle matters, need a more subtle energy for sustenance? After all, they also transform subtle energies within themselves. Or are they predominantly made up of what they feed on?
The Keeper of Knowledge praised the disciple for his excellent grasp of the material on the hydrogen tree and began to explain.
Yes, they are nourished by our emotions, thoughts, meaning hydrogens, 48, 24, and 12. H12 is emitted during orgasms, so it is not necessary to experience them in order not to provide food for the planets. We must gather energy and direct it towards elevated emotions, instead of foolishly spending it and providing the planets with another calorie-laden meal. All these things are what the planets feed on. Human bioplasma, H96, is also part of their diet. We must remember that our thoughts, impressions, emotions, which can be attributed to the category of lower ones, all of this is food for celestial bodies, but they do not further transform this energy. They cannot, like humans, digest coarse food and produce subtle energy. They do not have this mechanism. Therefore, planets only absorb the energy emitted by living beings, and this food goes nowhere beyond that.
Thank you, wisest one. We've got it sorted out.
Michael summarized his exploration of the planetary energy exchange chain. He passed the floor to Violet, who had tried to ask a question several times, but waited until the other disciples finished discussing the topic of planetary energy exchange.
Great, Master. I have a few thoughts on the development of planets. Each of them strives to become a sun, right? Each planet gradually needs to elevate its level. But how does their development occur? For example, humans, through enlightenment, certain realizations, and the rejection of false identities, evolve. But how about planets? What do they need to do to become a sun eventually? What needs to happen?
The Keeper bestowed a thoughtful and caring gaze upon the insightful disciple, rushing to appease her curiosity.
Firstly, it's important to understand that a planet has a primary function.
He began explaining.
the planet attempts to oversee certain processes on Earth, to control them. If it performs this function well, it earns a deserved promotion.
Just like humans,
the girl remarked, smiling at the other disciples.
Exactly.
The master agreed.
In the case of successfully fulfilling their tasks, the planet becomes a sun. Just like every human, if they fulfill their function well, they approach becoming an angel and eventually achieve it.
If he couldn't handle anything, then he remained just as he was, a bedbug.
Sighed Violetta sympathetically, clearly imagining someone specific, a familiar image to her, under the guise of a bedbug.
Yes.
The sage smiled.
Then the person remains in their physical body.
So planets develop not physically, but spiritually?
Another disciple interjected.
So when we say that Venus transformed into the sun, it doesn't mean that it sprouted rays and blazed with the brightest light. It means that the spirit of Venus simply transitions into a higher being, into a star. So are we talking about the soul here?
Herman surprised himself with his conclusion and eagerly awaited the master's comments on this revelation. The master praised Herman's progressive thinking and affirmed,
"Yes, the soul of the planet incarnates into the next level as a star, transitioning into the sun. Physically, it may perish. For example, collide with another planet or disintegrate, like Phaethon. But its soul always remains. And if the soul of the planet has sufficiently developed, it moves on to become a sun or other stars."
The meticulous Aryan decided to illustrate the sage's words with an example.
"It means, Keeper, that Jupiter is closest to transitioning into a sun in terms of development. Jupiter has the most moons, so it's already structured and organized, compared to, for example, Mercury, which has nothing. So the spirit of Jupiter is more developed than the spirit of Mercury, and it will transition into a sun faster, right?"
"You reason correctly, Herman. Indeed, since Jupiter is larger, has more mass, and more moons, it is closer to the sun. And the moon, for example, since it's just Earth's satellite, it's still small, underdeveloped. Therefore, it's farther from becoming a sun."
Such profound knowledge inevitably gave rise to a lot of new questions. The disciples, with amazement and excitement, progressed further in their inquiries, picking up each other's thoughts, complementing them, and developing a collective understanding of the stages of cosmic energy distribution.
"May I ask?"
Milena continued Herman's train of thought, her cheeks tinged with excitement and interest. In her eyes, burning curiosity was evident as she wasted no time in continuing.
"Master, when a planet reaches the maximum point of its progress after it becomes a sun, or even further into becoming some other star, at what point does this energy need to return to the human body to lead it to enlightenment? Or did I misunderstand this process? It seems to me that there are two scenarios of development. For example, one soul achieves enlightenment through planets and the sun, through a long path, while another one, in a physical body, does everything to come to the truth and no longer return to the physical body, merging with God. How does it all happen? Please tell us."
The Keeper of Knowledge greatly appreciated when disciples offered their conjectures and made assumptions. It trained the flexibility of their thinking and fostered flights of fantasy. After attentively and with pleasure listening to Milena, he gently adjusted her thoughts.
"There are many self-developing beings, not necessarily humans. They could be some green people, aliens, any intelligent creature. If we talk about a planet, it's also an intelligent entity, and it can evolve on its own. It doesn't necessarily need to be in a human body for that. It evolves in its own way, in its own body, and can reach certain heights as well."
"So they don't have the goal of enlightenment?"
Ildar clarified. The young man felt a bit embarrassed for interrupting Milena, who clearly intended to continue asking questions. He guiltily glanced at the girl, but she signaled that she was going to ask the same thing, so Ildar decided to proceed.
"The soul that passes through the human body has a path to enlightenment. It seeks to rid itself of suffering, merge with God, and not return. And then, perhaps, God will send our souls somewhere."
No, Ildar.
The sage shook his head, beginning to explain the correct interpretation of his words.
I said, any intelligent creature.
The master emphasized this phrase.
For example, a bedbug. It's not an intelligent creature. If a bedbug enters a human body, then it can develop. If it enters the body of an alien or some green people, if it has already become an intelligent being, then that creature can further develop on its own. But if the soul enters a non-intelligent body, like a cat or a dog, which is a non-intelligent creature, then it doesn't evolve. However, for example, a planet, that's already an intelligent entity. It has more intelligence than a human. Therefore, a planet can also evolve. It just perfects itself differently, in a different way of development. It's difficult for us to imagine or metaphorically depict this process, but development still occurs. If it's a thinking being, it can already tune into transformation and strive to become better.
Ildar uttered,
"Now I understand what was meant. Thank you for the detailed explanations, dear master."
The student had barely finished his sentence when a gust of wind burst into the pavilion through the open windows, extinguishing several candles. The disciples shivered, and the keeper of knowledge kindly announced a short break so the disciples could close the shutters, fetch blankets for themselves, and recreate the cozy atmosphere. Taking advantage of the opportunity, the keeper of knowledge allowed the disciples who remained in the pavilion to ask personal questions. Such questions were always with the disciples, because precious moments of communication with the great guru about what troubled their souls were a way to heal, to rid themselves of suffering and anxiety. The keeper rose from his chair and approached Irene, who was the first to volunteer and speak with the sage. Being so close to the master, the woman became slightly nervous, but when the sage took her hand, all her anxiety dissolved in his warm, gentle palms.
"Master, yesterday I noticed that I felt offended,"
Irene began speaking softly.
"I didn't catch it immediately, but then the process started. I saw this offense, repented, and apologized to the person. It didn't make me feel any better. The offense stood like a lump in my throat, and in the morning, I still felt it even during practice. I prayed, asked God, I just don't want to be in this state. I want relief, but it doesn't go away. It just stands here."
The girl sensually placed her hand on her neck, indicating how strongly this emotion weighed on her.
"Then miraculously, during trance, the lightness came. But still, even sitting here now, I feel this influence on myself. Tell me, Great One, how did it happen that the offense only disappeared during trance? I understand that this feeling doesn't go away immediately. It's slow, burdensome. Can you explain how this process occurs? Does it require effort? I noticed that some sisters walk around in this state for weeks. Why does it take so long?"
The keeper of knowledge pondered for a moment, choosing the right words. He had the task to answer such a complex question as succinctly and clearly as possible, one that touched not only Irene, but also all the other disciples who anxiously awaited the sage's response.
"Now I will try to explain to you what happens in our body when we feel offended. As I mentioned before, there's a wrong assessment, and it includes emotions, and emotions, in turn, trigger the action of certain enzymes. Certain processes are activated inside the body, and these enzymes are released and they kind of linger in the body. They can last quite a while, maybe 15 to 20 minutes. If they're not further fueled, they start to dissipate. It's necessary to pay attention to our sensations. Think, all right, I have a wrong assessment here. Let me approach it differently now. Let me laugh at it. Once you laughed, but then forgot about it, and again the old part gets activated, and this old assessment triggers this state again. We feel unpleasant sensations in the body. Again, we track the sensations, try to get angry at this wrong assessment of the situation, disidentify with it, and then relief comes again. Then the defense mechanism weakens again, and again our old part comes out. which gives the wrong assessments as before, and again this state comes back. Then we decided to look at it from the side, and so on. This can cyclically happen for a long time, until the situation starts to be forgotten by us, or until this wrong assessment is overcome.
But it's better to overcome it, right?
Another disciple, Eric, asked.
What's an effective way to do it, Master?
The great Master nodded affirmatively.
It needs to be overcome, replaced with the correct assessment. And this cannot happen instantaneously, only by your desire in that very moment. You need to repent, express gratitude, ask for forgiveness for the situation, and so on. It requires prolonged, diligent work on oneself for this assessment to disappear.
And is this assessment natural by nature? Or is it also the result of negative conditions and toxic upbringing?
This assessment has been ingrained in us. It has been hammered into our heads for years.
The Master said sternly, with a clear note of regret.
Adults set an example. Look, you should get offended like this, throw a tantrum like that, make a scene like this. In other words, they showed us. We read about it in books, saw it on television in shows, and involuntarily absorbed it from childhood. And now we need to change all that. So it takes a long time to work on ourselves, to repent, pray, give thanks, to do all this, so that this false assessment gradually disappears. And if it disappears, then we will be freer. This complex process will no longer arise.
Irene gently inquired.
So it turns out, wisest one, that this assessment in me is cyclically overcome and reappears. The body reacts to these sensations as to an illness, and that's why it feels bad.
Yes, Irene,
confirmed the Master.
And one has to do this for a long time, so that it finally disappears. But it's better to imagine it, because events may unfold in such a way that such a situation may not arise for a long time. Over time, we forget that we wanted to practice on this, and at the most crucial moment, we find ourselves unprepared and succumb again to the influence of wrong assessments. And if we periodically imagine it in our minds, it becomes a kind of training. When a situation arises, it will be easier to guide ourselves through how to react and how to evaluate. In imagination, you can imagine some past situations that once hurt, and imagine how you would react to them now. With laughter, joy, or observing from the sidelines. And over time, such a reaction will become a right habit.
The grateful disciple beamed with a happy smile. She felt immense relief right then. The lump in her throat dissolved with every word spoken by this amazing person. Now in her arsenal, she had the strong support of the Master and the knowledge he bestowed upon her, the fear from herself, from the possible recurrence of unpleasant sensations and the consequences of internal offense, retreated. She was confident in herself and already remembered several situations from the past on which she intended to practice her newly acquired skill. Gradually, the disciples began to return to the gazebo, although the designated break time had not yet expired. During the hustle and bustle, David respectfully approached the great guru, asking for permission to fill the short pause with meditative sounds. The sage had never objected to making music, and the disciple pulled out two instruments from his bag. They were a medium-sized steel tongue drum and a small triangle. David positioned himself next to the keeper and offered Anna to accompany him, to which she willingly agreed. Everyone froze in anticipation. Smoothly, the sounds of the cosmic instrument filled every inch of the gazebo's space. The hands of the disciple slid across the intricately painted surface of the steel tongue drum, producing a sound unlike anything else. Whether the presence of this amazing instrument was David's planned surprise, having learned in advance from the Master the topic of the conversation, or whether it was a miraculous coincidence, remained a mystery to all. However, a better musical accompaniment for a conversation about the cosmos could not be imagined. Anna had never dealt with the instrument entrusted to her before, but miraculously, she managed to hit the right notes in time. The subtle chimes of the triangle, sounding as a separate melody, complemented it and carried the thoughts of the listeners far upwards, closer to the stars. The disciples closed their eyes and turned into one big unity of pure energy. No one could understand how long the spontaneous sound meditation lasted. The deep, trance-inducing sound of Aum emanating from the master turned out to be the missing element in the ensemble. It seemed that the vibrations emanating from the small pavilion on the edge of the valley reached all the way to the sun. Soon the keeper of knowledge fell silent, thus announcing the end of the final cadence. With the last quiet notes, the disciples awakened from their slumber. Everyone gratefully thanked David for the opportunity to return to a state of elevated feelings. The short musical break contributed to the inflow of new strength for the assimilation of knowledge. Soon, the disciples tuned back into the serious conversation and, wrapped in blankets, prepared to absorb the truth. Renat immediately raised his hand. He was a tall, sturdy man with broad shoulders and a strong-willed face. The Keeper of Knowledge nodded in response, indicating readiness to listen to the disciple's question.
"Master,"
began the disciple in a deep voice,
"during the break, I reconsidered everything we talked about today and realized that all people, or more precisely their negative emotions, are being fed by anyone who cares to do so."
Renat's words carried a vivid note of amusing candor. He childishly waved his hands and continued.
"The spirits from the dark world feed on our negativity. The planets feed on it. People themselves also feed on negativity from each other. So does it mean that if a person doesn't meet a master, they won't be able to break out of this cycle of samsara? How can they attain enlightenment?"
"Good observation,"
noted the keeper, casting a careful glance at everyone present, ensuring that the disciples were tuned in for reception.
"Indeed, if a person doesn't meet a master on their path, then unfortunately, they won't attain enlightenment. I've already given such an example. If a child is left among animals, they will be raised as an animal. If left among dogs or monkeys, they will learn to climb trees or bark, chew bones, but they will never become human. When a person is born and lives in normal, familiar conditions, they become human. But since people around are mostly underdeveloped and foolish, the child will also grow up underdeveloped. In such a case, for a person to further develop, they must meet someone more intelligent and learn everything from them. They must meet a superhuman who is fully developed or close to such a state. Only then can they continue to grow. Therefore, one must find a master, a person who is more developed than all other people. Under their guidance, one can progress, explore the subtler matters of this world, learn to understand them, learn the right path on which they too will strive to become superhumans."
"So, if one doesn't encounter a superhuman, they won't become a superhuman themselves?"
Renat clarified.
"Exactly."
The keeper nodded firmly.
"Because people always depend on the environment they're in and on who teaches them. If a person is taught by dogs, all they will know is dog behavior. There was a case where a girl was raised among monkeys. When they found her, they couldn't turn her back into a normal human because she had already formed as a chimpanzee, mainly guided by instincts, unable to reason, unable to think logically. Therefore, here, in modern civilization, we have already formed as underdeveloped, foolish people. Now we need to interact with superhumans, to strive to become like them, and to develop. Then we can evolve further, become superhumans and angels."
There's a saying, you become like those you hang out with.
Milena inserted a brief comment.
That's right,
the sage said, continuing to respond to the question.
If a person doesn't interact with someone better than them, they won't be able to develop and become better themselves. That's a fact. Therefore, the first principle is, always interact with someone better than you. Whatever it may concern, always strive to surround yourself with people who excel in something. Those people who you want to emulate at certain moments, who do something better than you, or live more rightly than you. Interact with those who are better than you. Then you can learn something, get some help from them. But if you hang out with alcoholics, a lunatic, underdeveloped bugs, what can you get from them? You'll never become better. They'll drag you down. So, for us to improve, we must definitely interact with those who are better than us. That's the basic principle. And then we can develop, and something good will happen in our lives.
The disciples listened attentively to the sage. Some of their faces expressed a difficult thought process. The disciples carefully analyzed their surroundings. The listeners remembered those with whom they managed to grow, who they admired, and from whom they learned what they can do now. At the end of their contemplation, each of them looked at the keeper of knowledge with a trembling feeling that very superhuman was sitting right before them now, powerful and serene, experiencing unconditional love for his diligent disciples. He embodied the true path to spirituality in the right environment. However, there was also a reverse side to the analysis. Among the people they have to interact with daily in various spheres of life, the disciples could clearly identify several negative personalities exerting a bad influence. For example, Nathan suddenly thought of his brother. They had lived together for many years, despite having a colossal difference in development and lifestyle. Luke, Nathan's brother, was quite lazy. His entire life flowed steadily and quietly. Luke loved to contemplate and philosophize while harboring absolute disgust for activity. Energetic people like Nathan, who found it difficult to stay in one place for long, irritated him. However, the observant disciple still noticed that with prolonged interaction with his brother, he seemed to slow down himself. His usual activity became a burden. In the midst of these reflections, Nathan associated his brother with the word laziness. After contemplating this a little more and firmly deciding to control his energy contrary to the influence of his passive brother, the disciple returned to reality, bringing with him a newly born question for the master.
Great keeper,
he began thoughtfully,
do planets have laziness and spirits? Is it possible that spirits are lazy to communicate with us, lazy to give hints? For example, animals don't have laziness because they need to survive in nature. But humans also need to be active for their health. So why don't we embed this in our subconscious? Many people lead a passive lifestyle nowadays. At what point did this laziness attach itself to humans, become inherent to them?
Interesting question, Nathan.
The master highly appreciated the disciple's sequence of thoughts that led him to such questions. After pondering for a few seconds, the sage responded,
laziness is directly related to the power of inertia. The power of inertia exists everywhere. If we talk about planets, then they also have it. Humans should also be active due to inertia. However, various factors influencing people from all sides restrain this activity. Because if you start touching any object under the influence of the power of inertia, it will begin to slow down, stop. And the more such touches and interactions from the surrounding environment, the faster it will stop or remain immobile. This is called inertia of rest. It is this power of inertia of rest that manifests in humans as laziness. Wild animals have this all naturally formed because no one restricts their movement. No one swaddles little animals, tells them not to run, not to jump, not to growl, howl, bark. No one tells them that. No one stops them.
The keeper of knowledge intentionally paused, emphasizing the importance of the phrase. Such highlighted fragments were always better remembered by the disciples.
Animals need to find food, make great efforts, constantly be in motion, find food, hunt for it, and fight for it with other animals. In other words, animals develop normally in their natural environment, so the concept of laziness is unfamiliar to them. An animal is lazy only when it sleeps, but at other times, it acts actively. But humans have been crippled by improper upbringing and improper conditions. If their laziness were normal, natural, it would manifest only during sleep and brief rest, and upon waking up, the person would be very active again. But when a child has already been crippled, they fall asleep all the time. They sit down and immediately fall asleep. They constantly think, how can I sleep? Because such a lifestyle and type of thinking have already been instilled in them. They were told, don't run, don't jump, don't do anything, sit still like in school, raise your hand like a robot. They invented daytime quiet hours and forced children to sleep, even if they resist, just so they wouldn't be active, run around, or make loud noises. All these actions crippled humans, made them foolish. Therefore, laziness in humans is hypertrophically developed, and they need to unlearn it to make it normal. Normal is when you are very tired, fall asleep, and at that moment, the power of inertia, the power of tamas, manifests itself. Energy accumulates while sleeping. When the person wakes up, they have gathered energy and no longer want to go back to sleep. But what do we see in modern realities? A person has just woken up but is already sluggish, doesn't want anything, wants to go back to sleep. Because they have been severely crippled, cultivated laziness in them for generations. Now they will have to unlearn this, recover from this crippled state, become more active, to become whole humans again. Like a little child in childhood, before being crippled, everything interested them. They climbed everywhere, explored everything, constantly moved, ran, wanted to play, do something else. And then gradually they were crippled and crippled, and nothing interested them anymore. They grew up and lay on the couch, drank beer. You can't get them up. They turn into such primitive people. And now we also need to retrain ourselves and free ourselves from sick upbringing, from these limitations instilled in us. And then we will become normal people.
Master, but in the lecture about the ray of creation, it is said that it is at the level of the earth that three powers act, tamas, rajas, and sattva. Nathan continued to delve into this topic, trying to get to the essence. So, it turns out that crippled upbringing turns tamas into laziness. But then, it follows that, on a higher level, where the planets are, there is no tamas, and consequently, no laziness, because these three powers do not act there. Am I thinking correctly? The disciple said skeptically. Or are there other powers transforming into laziness, and the planets can also be lazy? The sage smiled kindly, amused by the intricate logical conclusions Nathan was trying to draw.
I will explain everything now.
He continued to smile softly, addressing everyone. Seeing how interested the disciples were in the master's train of thought and Nathan's questions.
No, these three powers act at each level, starting from the absolute, where the Holy Trinity resides. The Holy Trinity are the three powers at the level of the absolute. These three powers act at each level. It's just that when they operate at a lower level, they accumulate on other powers that act at that level. And so these three powers of each level start to accumulate on top of each other. And in the end, there are already many such powers that act in different directions. There are many of these triads. That's why it's so hard for us to live, because many of these triads affect us. If there were only one boss, then only he would influence us, and it would be good. But when we have 10 bosses, and each pulls us in different directions, one to the left, another to the right, then living becomes difficult. Imagine, you're alone, and above you, 10 bosses are directing, each with their own mood and tasks prepared for you. But when you have only one boss, then it becomes easy. Therefore, the lower we descend, the more these triads accumulate from different levels, planets, stars, galaxies. As a result, we get these 48 laws that exert their influence, and on someone who is even lower, 96 laws already influence. In certain cases, the moon begins to act, and then a person feels unwell. If a person gets sick, then already 96 laws, it becomes even harder. If a person ends up in a mental hospital, there too more laws start to act, and so on. That's why these triads accumulate. But these triads exist at every level. The other thing is, when these three gunas are not balanced, that's when some malfunction occurs. For example, tamas. Right now, tamas is being strongly developed in us. They say, sit, lie down. Earlier, on the contrary, they said that one must be hardworking, fight against the laziness and idleness, be ashamed of it. They said, go fetch water, chop wood. There was a lot of physical work. There was no time to be lazy. But then industrialization came. Machines started doing everything for people. And then tamas began to develop. That's when lazy people appeared, who wake up in the morning or during the day, and then go back to sleep because they were brought up incorrectly from childhood. That's why there might be a bias towards tamas.
Attentive disciple Siana raised her hand.
And is there a bias towards Raja's master, or a bias towards Sattva?
Yes, my dear,
said the sage, addressing everyone at once and then returning his gaze to Siana.
There are biases towards Rajas. In this case, a person becomes too active, restless, then goes to doctors, complains of insomnia, asks for medicines to sleep peacefully. Something constantly bothers such a person, agitates them, they start doing something. Or there can be too much sattva. In such a bias, a person usually ends up in a mental institution. They constantly have some formulas, theories arise.
Here the keeper of knowledge recalled a story and transformed into a benevolent storyteller in an instant. Making his voice mysterious and intriguing, he spoke.
Once upon a time, there was a genius in the asylum. He came up with the theory of the bandage and the bow tie.
The disciples laughed at the absurdity of this name, anticipating another humorous story from the sage. Meanwhile, he continued.
The theory stated, if there is a bandage, then you can tie many different bow ties from it.
The master fell silent, mimicking the madman. The disciples froze, waiting for the continuation, but the keeper raised his hands directly.
That's the whole theory. What else are you waiting for from a person in the asylum?
Laughter erupted in the gazebo. It seemed that even several birds perched on a nearby branch flew away from the sudden noise. After weathering the wave of uncontrollable laughter, the sage continued.
If he ran out of bandages, he would deliberately cut himself, ask the nurse to bandage him, and then unravel himself and tie new bow ties from these bandages. Draw diagrams. He filled many notebooks and then walked around with a big suitcase of these manuscripts, trying to explain this theory of the bandage and the bow tie to everyone. And in his notes, everything was serious, by the way. Drawings, diagrams, schemes. Everything was as it should be. That's what excess sattva is. Then this madman wanted to sell his theory for $1 million, looking for investors. That is, he turned out to have an overdeveloped sattva, a strong bias, and that's why he was so restless, always thinking, composing these theories, became crazy, obsessed with his own nonsense. In his room, all the walls, sheet, floor, all surfaces were covered with some formulas and signs.
The disciples listened to the sage, literally with their mouths open in amazement. The story was funny and incredible, and the great master's acting skills made it even more expressive.
So there can be a bias in any guna,
the sage continued, pleased with the impression he had made.
And that's always bad. If the gunas work evenly, then everything is right, harmonious. Therefore, one must strive for the gunas to work in unison. When it's harmonious, then everything is normal. When you fall asleep, then the tamas guna acts. When you wake up, then rajas kicks in. Then you start thinking, sattva comes into play. Everything goes evenly, sequentially, cyclically, and all in balance. Then a person will be healthy physically and mentally, and will have plenty of energy for development. But if there's a bias in one direction, then it's already abnormal. Then it's necessary to seek treatment.
Sayana thanked the master, being greatly impressed by his words. The sage directed a beam of warmth towards the girl, calming her and seemingly bringing her back to reality. His enlightened face once again became serious, and because of that, his wise gaze became even more insightful than before. It took several minutes before one of the disciples gathered their thoughts and formulated another important, interesting question. It was Emma, a beautiful girl of short stature with an unusual hairstyle reminiscent of the 80s, with expressive lips covered in a light gloss.
Our dear master,
the girl began openly and emotionally.
Does each planet have an active, passive, and neutralizing power? I understand that in each order there is this law of three, namely the planet has positive and negative qualities. How do they manifest? Or does it only happen in the form of influence on our planet?
Emma had a bright, strong energy which was now expressed through an open, intense gaze at the master, full of absolute love and purity. The sage lowered his voice slightly and his tone became calmer to balance the energetic connection with the disciple. He replied,
"In each planet, in each rock, these three powers are present. They are everywhere and in everything, in any phenomenon whatsoever. There are always three powers present. If we look at these three powers under a microscope, we will see that it is nothing but the power of inertia, the passive power, powers of gravity, friction, any other influence, the active power, and the neutralizing power, the environment in which everything happens. The surrounding environment can be viewed differently. What surrounds us, we usually call the environment, but some distant influences of planets, stars, celestial bodies. This will also be the environment, that is, the influence of the third power. Therefore, the three powers are present everywhere at all levels, in everything that exists. Like, for example, a woman, passive power, a man, active power, and where they start to copulate, mate. That's the environment, that's the neutralizing power. Whether it's a table, a chair, a bed, a cinema, an auditorium, all this is the neutralizing power, the surrounding environment. It turns out that these two powers from different environments unite in the third, neutralizing power, which determines how, in which position, and where they will do it. Therefore, three powers are present everywhere, and they act in any rock.
Mei Li joined the conversation, a girl of Asian appearance with long, thin braids that stretched down to the line of her slender waist.
Master, you said there are three powers, active, passive, and neutralizing. But among the shamanic gods, there are four of them, as we know from your teachings.
The beauty bowed low on these words, in a sign of deepest respect for the knowledge and the sage who tirelessly nourishes the minds of his disciples.
How do we correlate the three main powers with the four mentioned by shamans? Please help.
The keeper of knowledge hurried to dispel the fog of misunderstanding in the beautiful girl's and other disciples' minds, who were also puzzled by this question.
Ulgin is the active power. Erlik is the passive power. Umai is the neutralizing power. And Tengri consolidates them all, like a whale, on which these three stand. Tengri created these three powers, they act, but he himself is beyond these powers. He is above them and contemplates how they function.
I see. Thank you.
Mei Li said concisely and bowed to the powerful master once again with true pleasure. Then she passed the word to Leon, who had long been eager to speak up. Pleased with this successful attempt to speak up this time, Leon enthusiastically began.
Great Master, if we consider planets from the point of view of astronomy, would it be correct to say that the planets want to, as it were, break away from the sun? In turn, the sun attracts them to itself, and because of this, orbits are created? This can also be translated into the action of the three powers, right? That is, the movement of the planet and its desire to fly away can be considered the active power. The sun can be seen as the passive power that attracts the planet. And the cosmos, it turns out, will be the neutralizing power acting as the surrounding environment. Is that correct?
Everything is correct.
The keeper echoed the disciples' words.
The cosmos will be the neutralizing power, and all the other planets, which also revolve, will be the active and passive powers. This way, any process and any phenomenon can be considered. Everywhere we will be able to trace the action of these three powers.
Outside, it began to drizzle. The pleasant white noise became the background for the continuation of the fascinating conversation. This added a special coziness to the midnight conversation of the sage with his curious disciples. Such an atmosphere seemed very intimate, the kind where the most sacred secrets are usually shared face to face. And it was happening here, in this wonderful place, not far from the temple. The disciples understood the uniqueness of the event. Here, within the walls of a small wooden structure, the great master instilled great knowledge into their minds. He did this in an atmosphere of love and care, like a kind father educating his ignorant children. They wanted to stop time, but lacking such powers, they eagerly and in great detail analyzed every phrase uttered by the keeper, listening with rapture to his answers to their questions, which were growing more numerous.
Dear Master, may I ask about the planets and how to relate to them?
Ilias raised up. He was a man of average height with thick black hair and green eyes. At first glance, it was difficult to determine his nationality. At times he claimed he was Buryat, at others, Kyrgyz. And sometimes, he even asserted that he had Sherpa roots from the Tibetan people. But every time the joke was over, Ilyas put on a serious face and stated that in reality, by nationality, he was a good person. Such an answer was always comprehensive. The man had refined manners, a certain aristocratic bearing, appearing more European than Asian. Yet, the true origin of the trickster remained a mystery to all, and no one wanted to unravel it. So fascinating was the process of speculation on the matter. Ilyas's question to the master was as follows.
In India, there are many different mantras used to communicate with the planets. Are these mantras effective, or should one feel the planet as a certain state, attune oneself, knowing, for example, from books or from your knowledge, what energy the planet carries? In general, I'm interested in learning how to interact with the planets. Will the mantras help? Are they effective, or are they just made up?
The mantra will help, Ilyas, if we know who we are addressing. The mantra is like a name. A name can help address a person. But if we don't know anything about them, don't understand who they are, then knowing that they are, for example, Serge, won't help us. We can't imagine what kind of person he is, so we can't interact with him properly. It's the same with a mantra. If we keep repeating it all the time without understanding its essence, nothing will change, and such a mantra will not work. We must imagine who Serge is in front of us, how he looks like. If we can imagine his appearance well, then we can interact somehow, use his name. We called out to Serge, pronounced his name, and he responded. Then the contact began. But if we don't know who this Serge is, what he is, at all, maybe they named a cat or a dog that way. We don't know, so it's unclear how to communicate. That's why we study mythology, look into Jupiter, Zeus, study Apollo, Venus, to have an idea. We start studying astrology, how this planet manifests, which qualities it has, tune in to all of this. Then we already have a good understanding of what this planet is, what influence it exerts, and we know exactly what we need from it, what we want to achieve with this mantra. If we recite the mantra, already knowing all this, reinforcing the effect with our emotions and experiences, then this mantra will definitely work with this understanding of what we want. And this understanding is supported by our emotions, experiences. Then this mantra will work. But if we can't imagine what's being talked about, we read somewhere in a book and started foolishly saying this mantra, then, of course, there will be no result.
Thank you, wisest one,
respectfully replied the disciple.
In that case, how does the mantra of our egregore work? Is it better to tune into you or into some field or into some state?
If the one performing this mantra knows the master, then it's better for him to tune into the master, of course. But if not acquainted with the master, then one should imagine that there is a school that helps people to develop. One should imagine that in this school, there's great knowledge that spiritualizes people, sets them on the path of truth, brings them closer to God. It is important to monitor one's feelings at this moment. Goodness must come to the heart, a strong desire to become enlightened oneself. Then a person can already tune into the egregore. After tuning in, one must continue to monitor one's thoughts. Tune them like this. I am now doing something good and bright for the egregore, helping it. When we tune in this way, the egregore also begins to help. But if a person has no idea about the egregore, then there's no need to do this mantra, just shaking the air. For example, someone said to a person, read this mantra and you will immediately become rich. Money will pour down on you. But the person has no idea what this mantra is about and what this egregore is. They can't imagine anything, can't tune into anything meaningful, and there will be no use. And then they'll spit and say, your mantras don't work.
The master amusingly mimicked the nasal voice of that ignoramus.
That's how a foolish person usually behaves. When they repeat the mantra like a donkey, they don't understand what the egregore is, don't think about what good, kind, bright things they can do for people or how they can carry out the will of the egregore in the world. They don't think about any of this and just foolishly repeat something they want for themselves. Then there will be no benefit from such repetition of the mantra.
I understand you, Keeper,
squinted Ilyas, recalling how he himself made a similar mistake in mantras and prayers at the dawn of his education several years ago. The master read this thought in the disciple's gaze and smiled at him sincerely, with the understanding of leaving this moment in the disciple's past. The sage sent him a silent beam of support, but in the face of the great man, it seemed more eloquent than any comforting words. This meaningful pause was interrupted by Radha's question. The woman, in her early 30s, with charming curls and a face radiant with joy, shone even brighter when she managed to seize a tasty piece of the keeper's attention.
Dear Master,
began the radiant disciple,
when depicting the gods of the planets, they are depicted in human form, aren't they? Why? Is this how the soul of the planet looks like? Or is this image conveyed to improve our perception?
The sage allowed himself a few seconds to admire the radiance emanating from the joyful disciple, and then began to explain.
Of course, it has to be possible for us to imagine it. Therefore, you could say it's done to improve the perception of the image. Humans are structured in such a way that they perceive faces most easily, so such images are better understood by them. There are different facial types. For Jupiterians, Saturnians, Venusians, each has its own type. And if we depict the planet with the corresponding face, then it becomes clearer to us. And if we don't depict a face in the representation of the planet, then we won't be able to perceive this planet on our level and won't be able to tune into it and interact with it. Therefore, if we depict Jupiter with the face of a Jupiterian, then it's much clearer to us what kind of planet it is and what influence it may exert. Such an image is more accessible to us in our language. Through these images, we communicate with the planet.
So, Master, if we see an image of how the sun perceives some planet, we won't be able to understand anything from that image.
Of course, Radha. In such an image, we won't understand anything. For example, there will be some vibrations which won't be clear to us. We won't know about them and won't be able to decipher them. But faces are understandable to us, and they help us to attune with the planets. But if we depict the planet in a different way, which is unfamiliar and unclear to us, then it will be almost impossible to tune to it.
The conversation about the images plunged one of the disciples into deep childhood memories. The master's words evoked in her some inexplicable nostalgia. She simultaneously experienced enthusiastic joy and a light melancholy in her heart. After a few minutes of quick analysis of the emerging sensations, Kira finally understood what her consciousness was trying to recall. Like the result of a search query, childhood drawings from a school contest popped up in her mind. Long ago, little Kira drew the Earth and its relationship to people on this planet at the master's assignment. Kira's Earth turned out to be very sad because the ecological condition was deteriorating and required more careful treatment. Kira remembered how hard she tried to convey the emotion of sadness and despair on the face of that very planet. However, after finishing the work and attaching it to the common board among others, the girl was amazed to discover that the Earth looked completely different to other kids, and it wasn't sad everywhere. In most cases, the face of the planet depicted joy, happiness, sometimes surprise or mild offense. The planet turned out to be the saddest and didn't win the contest. Since then, Kira's perceptions of this image have changed significantly, especially since her first meeting with the master. The words of the keeper brought her back from her reverie.
Were you about to ask something, Kira?
The bearer of truth leaned slightly, as if to gently and carefully awaken the girl from her oblivion. Mentally, the girl thanked the perceptive sage for the opportunity to formulate her question, so opportunely given to her.
Yes, yes,
she replied in a rush.
Dear master, how should we address the Earth? We pray for her and send her love. But how does she perceive this, considering that the Earth, like other planets, feeds on our negative emotions? How can she help us overcome difficulties and our negativity if she feeds on it? I'm confused. Is the Earth with us or not?
The great sage bestowed upon the disciple a loving, attentive gaze and eagerly began to answer.
Earth and other planets feed not only on negative emotions, but also, for example, on orgasms. When this type of sexual energy is released, it also goes to feed the celestial bodies. People often contemplate something and then the planets are nourished by their thoughts. They don't necessarily have to be negative. For example, Jupiter.
The master gestured inspiringly, drawing the attention of the disciples with the movements of his hands, which worked hypnotically.
Jupiterians are characterized by their frequent involvement in some political activities. in certain events. They emit a lot of active energy, and the planets also feed on it. So you can't say it's entirely negative energy, but it's not exactly elevated either. This energy is created, the planet feeds on it, and through this energy, it shapes a certain situation on Earth. There is politics. There are various organizations and enterprises. In all these matters, Jupiterians are involved.
The sage emphasized an important point for memorization, then nodded to Maria, who raised her hand immediately after the keeper finished his thought.
"And how are Saturnians characterized, Great Master?"
the girl asked impatiently.
"Saturnians are scientists. They invent something, constantly come up with something new, constantly in the process of learning and exploration. Here too, a certain energy is emitted, Saturnian energy. Saturn feeds on this energy. It's not to say that it's entirely negative, but it's not very high either, not a religious ecstasy."
Kira entered the dialogue again to continue exploring an important aspect for herself.
"So, you mean, dear master, that each planet feeds on its own kind of energy, and this energy, to some extent, can be useful on Earth? Because good deeds are done with this energy."
"Yes, that's exactly what I wanted to say."
The master smiled gently at her.
"So you can't say that the planets are entirely negative. If there are some demons, then yes, they feed only on negative emotions. But the planets, they create their own energies, which are somewhat useful and somewhat harmful. For example, they created some politics, some enterprises, which seems like a good thing. But a person becomes a cog in this mechanism, devotes himself to this mechanism, and doesn't really gain anything from it. So we look at what we can get from which mechanism, besides money. Jupiterians, for example, don't get anything. But what are these riches? You can't buy God's grace with them. Therefore, we must always remember that first of all, we want to receive the grace of God, to become angels, not to get rich. We don't need to be just cogs in some production, in the banking mechanism, for example. We need to find ways to receive the grace of God. So we need to tune into higher influences, and then we get something more."
The sage's answer was extensive, and grateful Kira, touching her hand to her heart, sent sincere thanks to the master for the detailed explanations. The word was taken by the disciple Adelina, a beautiful, mature woman with a short, extravagant haircut.
"Great one. I really love a poem about the messenger that you recited several times in lectures. There are such lines. Touching people's hearts with freedom, they will leave when their time comes. Please explain the exact meaning of this poem, and who is it about? Who will leave, and what will happen to the earth? What will happen to it? Will only bedbugs remain? And will the earth die?"
Adelina spoke the last lines excitedly and slightly embarrassed, afraid that she might have misunderstood the meaning of the lines she loved so much. The Keeper of Knowledge sent a wave of gentle, protective energy to the heart of the disciple, beginning to explain the truth. Thus, Adelina was able to relax and listen intently, memorizing every word of her beloved master.
"God does not leave us without his messengers. There are definitely people of a high level, and they help the civilization to develop in the right direction. Only Christians came up with the idea that Christ came, and only he should save everyone." The sage furrowed his brow and continued fervently. "Only they didn't come up with why God didn't save them before. So many people lived before Christ. Why didn't their God save them? Christ came. He was only recognized in a small territory, and in China and America, no one heard about him for a very long time. Why is God so cruel, according to Christianity, that he only gave Christ to the Jews for a certain time? Were only the Jews supposed to be saved? And what about the other nations who lived before and in other places? Only Christians came up with such nonsense. In fact, everywhere there are Christs, superhumans, who constantly come, help people, save them. So God does not abandon us. The main thing is for a person to seek this Christ. He must seek the Master, must strive to find someone who will help them. You need to look for a place where superhumans live. Go study where there are better people of a higher level. If a person thinks like that, then God can help them. A person finds the Master, who then helps them to develop further. And if they don't seek anything, then even if Christ is nearby, they can't get anything from him, because they're busy with something else, with their own interests. They're not interested in what Christ is telling them. Why do they need it? They're busy in their own quagmire, and don't listen to what the Messenger of God commands them to do.
Thank you,
the disciple whispered silently with her lips. However, the great sage heard how loud her gratitude truly was for the calm thoughts and unconditional love which his every word was woven from. The concluding question on this moonlit evening was posed by Ruslan. In his question was encapsulated the main idea that the Master had imparted to his disciples today in their extraordinary knowledge.
Master, humans have chakras. Am I correct in understanding that these are receivers that perceive the energy of the planets? So each chakra manifests its own planet, its own specific energy, and on the other hand, are we food for our own planets? Can we say that if we are mechanical, then we are this food for the planets, but if we develop and work on ourselves, work on all chakras, then we receive this energy from the planets, and it is assimilated and transformed through the chakras?
Then we control this energy,
the sage corrected Ruslan.
We may not control them ourselves, and then these energies spiral us into the meat grinder. We don't control them ourselves, and they can control us. But if we become conscious, then we see this energy determine its source. For example, if we feel hormones racing in our blood, then we acknowledge to ourselves that sexual energy has begun to control us. We need to think about where this sexual energy is leading us, and the first desire that may arise is to have an orgasm. Then this energy will dissipate into space. The second thing that can result from it is children. Here, one needs to assess the risks and understand that children can become a burden and a difficult obstacle in many endeavors. If one is not prepared for this, and if it's not necessary, then we skip this option. And if sexual energy finds no outlet, then it will manifest as negative reactions and emotions. Then we need to understand that this is a subtle energy, hydrogen 12, H12. Remember that elevated emotions are also H12, and here it is, the way out. We can direct this energy towards elevated emotions, start entering a trance, transforming this power into elevated emotions. If we use this energy in this way, then we will be able to be in a state of divine grace. This is the most sensible option. This energy controls everyone in its own way, meaning that they reproduce, give birth to unwanted children, and then suffer from this decision until their death. But as it turns out, there is another way out, to approach it with a clear head, to apply reason, to find another way to use this energy. But for this, self-control is necessary. To control oneself, to direct oneself, so that this energy does not spin us, but we begin to control it. And so it is with all types of energy. Energy can spiral us into its own whirlpool under the influence of nature's settings. Or we take everything into our own hands and direct this energy towards what we need. So there are two ways out. Either like a boat, simply drift with the current, and wherever this energy carries us, it will carry us, or start controlling ourselves and sail in the direction we need.
Super.
Ruslan enthusiastically embraced the master's victorious sounding words, motivating for the immediate practice of the lessons learned.
Thank you, Keeper, for such explanations.
As they exited the gazebo, following the sage, each of the disciples, as if on cue, lifted their heads upwards. The bottomless blue expanse covered the sky, sparkling with millions of tiny bright dots. The large, apple-like moon illuminated the disciples' path to the temple. Many new thoughts illuminated their minds, but only one, like the Milky Way, stood out against the others now and afterwards. During the colorful night dreams, we are something more. We are not far from the cosmos. We are its inseparable part. Main Theses 1. The energy emitted by humans, spirits, extraterrestrial entities is food for the planets and a source of their existence. The more negative the energy, the tastier the dish at Saturn's brunch. 2. The sun and other stars feed on the energy of the planets and the positive emotions of humans. If we experience elevated emotions, we feed the galaxy itself. Mostly, the galaxy feeds on the energy of the stars. 3. Planets have souls and their own path of spiritual development. The goal of planets is to become suns, after which the elevated energy of the planet's soul is absorbed by the galaxy's black hole. 4. If a person does not encounter a master on their life path, they will not be able to achieve enlightenment and will continue to be merely a source of energy to nourish celestial bodies. 5. Souls of higher levels, incarnated in humans, utilize all the energy and knowledge intended for other people who did not make use of them due to the underdevelopment of their minds. Thus, they become superhumans. 6. The more enlightened people there are in your environment, the more enlightened you become yourself. 7. Daytime laziness is a developed bad habit instilled by an unreasonable society. In its resource state, a person is active during wakefulness, and their laziness has the nature of inertial rest. 8. In a normal body, the triad of energies, tamas, rajas, and sattva, remain in balance. Any imbalance towards one of the gunas signifies a deviation from the norm, which adversely affects the psycho-emotional state of a person. 9. To address the planets in mantras and prayers, it is necessary to visualize the image of the planet. Have an understanding of it. Such an image can be seen and remembered by studying mythology and the great knowledge imparted by the master. 10. The energy of orgasm is also food for the planets. For more conscious enlightenment, it is necessary to learn how to transform this energy into an elevated state. 11. We must learn to control our energy. Otherwise, energies will control us.
Do you want to know more? Watch the animated masterpiece that reveals the mysteries of humanity. Discover more sacred knowledge in books. You can meet the main characters of books at our seminars. Find your amulet of power. Participate in an individual ritual. Open free channel with daily spiritual practices for yourself. All these you will find on our website www.amazon1.org. Share this book and spread the great knowledge. Then people's lives will change for the better, and you will accumulate good karma and be able to help all your loved ones.